This is January 19th, 2009, and we're talking with Will Erickson, who's stationed in Oakland, California at this point. He produced the Pixel called I'm Not Beer, an answer to Todd Haynes' I'm Not There. Right, Will? That's what Todd Haynes' movies call, I'm Not There. Okay, Will, in the course of getting to know you after you made the I'm Not Beer, which I had no input in directing you in making it, I just provided the content, and then you did what you wanted to do, and people can see this on 5body.com or Dobbstown.com. All right.
Okay.
It is, in the course of getting to know Will after he made it and sent it to me, I found out some interesting coincidences that filled in a gap in my own interest of history on the West Coast. The Pixel, is that what we call it, a Pixel video?
The camera or the video?
Yeah, it was made for Jerry Fialka's Pixel Festival, right?
Yeah, Pixel This.
So
is the name of the festival.
Right, the Pixel This Festival, so that it can be seen as a pixel, or the pixel is the content of the video?
I think he likes to call them pixels. I tend to just call them videos, but he calls them pixels.
Right, but it was made with a pixel camera?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, it was made with a Pixel Vision camcorder.
Okay. So, in the course of talking about what Will had done, he used my tiny note chart that I've talked about many, many times. And the concept of Rai, or the notion of Rai that's in the at the top of the tiny note chart, Will didn't know anything about, and he wanted to know a bit more about that after he had made the video. It didn't matter in relation to the video, but in the course of explaining him explain to Will about Rai, it turned out that Will spent a good deal of his creative life at the heart of Rai in Olympia, Washington. Rai is a concept that came out of the cosmic awareness movement through Ralph Doobie, David Worster, and Paul Shockley. Now, a big chunk of that operation, starting in the 60s, was centered in Olympia, Washington, around a person named Winston Turnbow, who's more well known as Avaton. Now, an interesting thing that came up in the course of explaining this to Will was that Evergreen State College, is that what it is? Evergreen State College?
Yeah, the Evergreen State College.
Yeah, it's not Evergreen College. It's Evergreen State College. Yeah, I'm looking at the
It's actually the Evergreen State College. It's how they...
The Evergreen State College. Now, Dave Worster had an influence. The second medium for cosmic awareness had an influence on the original curriculum for the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, in 66, 67, when they were just designing it. And he gave a lecture to the staff, faculty, the president of that institution. And we find out later that Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons, do we say he's the creator of the comic strip, the show? What do you say when you say Matt Groening?
He created Life is Hell comics. And, he's the creative force behind The Simpsons. Started on the Tracy Ullman show, and then eventually, I think, lost control of it to Fox, and it became syndicated and all that.
Okay. So Matt Groening, who I met in the fall of 1977 in Los Angeles, he attended the Evergreen State College, and I always knew that, but I never met anybody who went there besides Matt. And finally, the person showed up, Will. So I want to direct this interview, after we get some basic biographical data, towards this phenomenon that comes out of Olympia, Washington. So, Will, where were you born?
I was born in Walnut Creek, California.
Where?
Which is in the East Bay, San Francisco's East Bay area.
Right. Did you have counterculture parents?
Yeah, to an extent, I'd say. My dad ran a rock magazine, a local rock magazine.
Oh, yeah. What was it called?
BAM.
BAM. Oh, yeah. Yeah, heard of that.
Yeah.
And that's all he did, or is he still doing it?
No, it actually, the internet kind of, it was a free magazine, so it depended on how it sales. So during the dot-com boom, all the advertising went to the internet, and print media suffered.
Right. It was. It's not a zine. It was a monthly.
Yeah. It was twice a month.
Oh, twice a month. But not nationally distributed?
It was specific to California. And originally it's just the Bay Area, and then eventually went down to L.A. too.
Is it like London's Time Out? It talked about weekly events?
Yeah. But it also, you know, it dealt with, like, any band that came out of California in, like, the 70s to the late 90s pretty much had their first interviews with BAM. It was, like, the premier outlet for all that.
Did you read it?
Like, everyone from... What's up?
Okay, go ahead. Everything from...
Oh, everything from, like, the Grateful Dead to, like, Tupac to... all kind of went through it.
Did you read it?
Not very much, no.
Okay, so you end up making films or videos. How does that background lead to this present creative medium you're using?
I don't know if it necessarily does, more than just an awareness of the media, I suppose, and the power of it born into me in some ways.
Would that be because your father worked with a medium? You think that?
Yeah, definitely.
Did you think that he had some kind of power when you were young?
No, I did not. But I was aware of the kind of the fallacy of the media, maybe, you know, like what goes on behind the scenes and what that. The extent of the power of the media, perhaps.
Right, as a separate thing from the creators, and the creators did not seem as powerful.
Well, it was a tangible thing, as opposed to, like, a far-out thing, you know?
Say that again? What was that about tangible?
Oh, it was a tangible thing, like the media itself, producing magazines or music or whatever else was a tangible thing, as opposed to something that was out of reach, I guess.
And that's what you mean. That's what you mean by having power. Something that was tangible.
Yeah.
That you could get into.
Right.
Right. So you were born in the early '80s, right?
Yeah, in 1983.
So when did you start making films, or whatever?
I started making films a couple of years ago, but I've been, like, drawing and writing and all that since I was little.
Do you think your parents' environment encouraged that?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, if you were living in a completely different kind of, let's say a fundamentalist Christian home, would you still be writing and drawing when you were young?
Probably not the same sort of things.
Right. So there was an atmosphere of expressing oneself there. So, did you do that kind of major in high school?
In high school, I pretty much only took English classes.
You could limit the kind of courses you took?
Kind of. You only had to take, a certain amount of all the other classes. Like, you had to take 2 years of math, 2 years of science. You had to take one art class or 2 years of a language to graduate and all that. And I just took English classes. I took about 10 years of English classes in 4 years of high school. And that's the bare minimum.
10 years of English reading?
Yeah, English and lit, yeah.
And why that?
I really liked it. That was the only thing. I wanted to be a writer.
Yeah.
And it kind of came easy to me, so I just focused on that.
Oh, so you were even maybe gearing to be going to a college creative writing workshop kind of environment.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't think I was going to go to college, but yeah.
So what were your authors that you that recall that stood out back then? What books?
Let's see. Not Tom Robbins. First, Kurt Vonnegut, probably.
Yeah.
From a young age. And then I read all of those, the kind of utopian novels, or like the anti-utopian novels.
Like Brave New World, or?
Brave New World and all that
1984,
stuff.
Any 19th or earlier?
No, like that, yeah, like Brave New World, 1984, Clockwork Orange.
But from the 19th century,
Yeah, definitely 19th century in high school. And pretty much always, I'd say. I've always kind of focused on that.
Did you read Thomas More's Utopia, which is about 500 years ago?
No, I never read Thomas More's Utopia.
Right, so it's more the last 100 years.
Right.
Did you read
Towards the end of school, I started reading Tom Robbins' books.
Right.
And that actually inspired me to move first to Oregon and then to Olympia. Oddly enough.
Well, you know, Tom Robbins hung out with Dave Worster.
Right.
The medium for cosmic awareness. That's. Did you know that?
I think either you told me that or Jerry told me that.
Okay.
I think it was you. It must have been you who told me that.
Okay. So Tom Robbins' books influenced you. And, you know, on the chart, the Tiny Note chart, in the Thompson quadrant where I have Cowgirl, to my mind, I think of even cowgirls get the blues.
Right.
You know, so Robbins is, implied in there. And especially, I think it came out in the period 67 to 72, which is that quadrant. I think it came out in 71 or so. Not sure. I could check that. So then what happened when you graduated from high school? Did you go to university right away?
I went to the University of Southern Oregon in Ashland for about a year and was really fed up with that, and then got into Evergreen and transferred over there.
And this was the, you said the University of Southern Oregon?
Of Southern Oregon.
Hmm. And
which is in Ashland.
Right. And did you take English there again?
Yeah. I took English classes. It's a traditional college, so there's prerequisites and all that. So I was focusing on prerequisites while I was there. But really, I didn't like it very much at all. And I was hanging out with the kind of nefarious locals around there.
Almost like the kind of people I saw on your Safe Harbor TV DVD you sent me.
Yeah, kind of those types of people.
Yeah, the underbelly.
Yeah, definitely the underbelly.
Or street culture, different team terms like that, right?
Yeah, just kind of like a Southern Oregon, alcoholic, degenerate, speed freak, thieves.
Right.
Or whatever.
And what didn't you like about the school?
It just wasn't. I couldn't really get into it for whatever reason.
Okay, I just noticed that even Cowgirls Get the Blues comes out in 76, so it wasn't 76, but his first book was in 71, another roadside attraction.
Right, which is a great book, too.
Yeah. Okay, so the. But if he wrote Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, we could say it started after 71. In that 67 to 72 period, and he didn't get it out till 76. Trying to fit it into the chart here. Okay, so how did you hear about Evergreen State College?
My friend Tom actually was going there, and I went to visit him up there. Actually, I met him in Eugene, and he came with some other people from Evergreen, and I thought they were pretty interesting. And then I went to visit him up there and thought it was pretty amazing.
Well, what would be attracting up there? Attractive? What is it that stands out?
at the time, I was really into the trees, first of all.
Yeah.
And, like, I've never really been that nature-driven, which is the air felt really good to breathe. And it seemed like there's a lack of, like, a general lack of control in, like, in being forced there, which I thought was pretty interesting.
You mean you could, you didn't have to go to classes?
Or you didn't have to obey the laws as much as you did in Oregon.
You mean the laws of the grounds of the university?
Yeah, and, like, the police in general seem much more lax. And just everything seemed much more lax there.
And what was the population? What was the population then?
I have no idea. What the student body or the...
No, Olympia.
Olympia? I have no idea.
So this would be not 2002.
Yeah, 2002.
Yeah. So September 11th, 2001 has happened. Did that affect you in any way?
Yeah, I my decision to move away.
To go to Evergreen or to leave the Southern Oregon College.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely. I remember thinking, because at the time they were saying that the Bay Area was going to be attacked with a nuclear bomb or a biological bomb or something like that. And I remember seeing on the internet, like, charts of, like, where you lived, whether or not the blast would hit you if it was detonated in San Francisco, you know, because of the hillsides and all that. So I wanted to avoid that if it was going to happen. So I decided to move up north where they didn't really pay much attention to it internationally.
Right. So that happens in the fall of 2001. When do you actually get and apply and get to Evergreen in 2002?
In 2002, fall 2001, fall 2001 is my last year of high school. And then the beginning of 2002, the school year of 2002, so I guess the end, like September, is when I moved to Ashland. And then really 2003 is when I moved to Evergreen.
The fall of 2003?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. So, yeah, 2001, the fall of 2001, you finish high school. No, you have your last year of high school.
Right.
And so your last year of high school is under the cloud of September 11th, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so then you get to Ashland. That's like getting out of San Francisco. And you do 1 year there, 2002 to summer of 2003, then you move up to Olympia in the fall of 2003.
Yeah.
Okay. So, did you know that Matt Groening had gone there before you went?
I did know that. And I knew that the Hollywood bank robber had gone there too.
Who's that?
He was a bank robber who I'd seen a show about on like A&E a couple of years beforehand. Who went to Evergreen, was a chemistry major, lived in a tree house or something, cooked a bunch of speed, and then moved to Hawaii, where he lived in another tree house, cooked even more speed, made a bunch of money, then I think moved back to the mainland and started robbing banks. And he's called the Hollywood bank robber because he was really charismatic.
What, he had something to do with Hollywood?
No, he was just like, he'd smile, and it was really theatrical, so the press dubbed him the Hollywood bank robber. Because in Washington, you know, that charisma equals Hollywood for whatever reason.
And this, where was he robbing the banks?
I think he's robbing the banks up in Washington.
Oh, okay.
I'm not entirely sure where, but I know he went to Evergreen. So at the time, I was aware of Matt Groening and the Hollywood bank robber.
So when you get there, you mentioned to me before that he donated a building. Matt Groening donated a building there, or funded it, or something.
The top floor of the communications building. I could be wrong about this, but I was told, as always told, that it's his money that paid for it, which is where I studied animation, which eventually turned into movies in general.
Okay, so in 2003. You're still trying. You're going up to Evergreen. Are you still thinking of being a writer?
Yeah. I took a class called the Islands class, where everyone picked an island and went there for a couple months and did an anthropological study and came back and kind of lectured on it or whatever. I chose the island of Manhattan.
Oh, yeah?
My sister lived there. And actually, during that time, I got involved with the Yippies, which is kind of interesting.
You mean Dana Beale?
Yeah, Dana Beale.
Down on 9 Bleecker Street?
Yeah.
You were down there? I dropped in there occasionally in that period. Well, you know, you're talking 2003, 2004?
Yeah, but probably like the very beginning of 2004 is when I was in over there.
Yeah, I dropped in there a couple times. Not often.
I split my time up between there and the Byron Poetry Club and then Collective Consciousness, or Collective Unconscious.
Yeah.
On the Lower East Side.
Yes. What was that? I don't know. What was Collective Unconscious? Is that a bookstore?
You know, it was a performance space.
Oh yeah.
And it was pretty amazing, but it got shut down.
That's right. And I know Dana Beale had a problem with the landlord or something in 2006 or 7. Did you hear about that?
Yeah. And but he declared it a museum or something, right?
Yeah.
And that kind of gave him.
Yeah.
Protection.
So he got out of that. He's still there.
Yeah, as far as I know, he's still there.
Did you know that Lynn LaRouche accused him of shooting, him and Paul Krasner, of shooting and setting up the assassination of Ronald Reagan?
I did not, but I do know that in the Secret History of the 70s, the collective publications of the Yippie Press or whatever that they published, there's a lot of articles in there about Lyndon LaRouche being a fascist.
Yes.
Which I'd bring up to the LaRouche supporters in Olympia, and they'd flip out on me.
How would they express a flip out?
They have an interesting method of just pulling out words that they think that you'll respond to, and then trying to discredit you really quickly.
So they want to press your button.
Yeah, but they'll say things like isosceles triangle or whatever else, so that you'll kind of start thinking along the same lines as them in theory.
Oh, you mean they try to immediately give you their concepts that hypnotize you? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, like they're like recently I ran into some when I was making I'm Not Beer on BART in San Francisco. And they were saying, like, you know, aren't you ready for regime change regarding Bush and all that?
Or the higher hypothesis? Ready for the higher hypothesis? Something like that?
No, they said, like, do you want to return to FDR-style government?
Yeah.
And they, you know, they're just trying to, like, feed me something that in theory I'd go along with.
Right. So you're saying that if you mentioned, yeah, they weren't trying to find out what you were and then insult you. They immediately tried to give you their jargon, their vocabulary. If you distract you from whatever issue you brought up is what you're saying.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, let's go back here. So Dana Beale, so you're in the students would have to pay for the island they went to? They would have to pay for the layout?
Yeah, you'd have to pay for everything. So, like, some people went, like, this one girl went to an island on the Aleutian Chain.
Yeah.
And she worked at, like, a fish canning shop, like, a fish canning factory, and actually generated money by working there and did her report on that whole culture. And then other people went to, like, New Zealand and got high and bungee jumped and did all that. So, you know, it depended on the person's motivation, what they were going to do.
But these are freshmen. This is your first year in the university.
It was technically my second year of college, but yeah, it was my first year. I think you had to be a sophomore or above.
Oh, okay.
For this.
So, you haven't been given any training in anthropology or anything?
No, other than in the class.
Beg your pardon?
Other than in the class, no.
But it wasn't technically an anthropology course. That
was. It actually kind of was. Yeah, there's definitely a focus on anthropology and a focus on botany and
on botany. What did you say?
Yeah, on botany, we had to. Part of it was we had to identify the plants of the region that we're going to, and like the wildlife, study the wildlife.
So you identified a lot of marijuana down there in Manhattan.
Well, yeah, I tried to. I went to Central Park. I went to the Bramble and identified some plants there.
Okay, so you would go on this trip after a few months of the course.
Yeah, after it was in the last. It was in between like the second and third quarters.
Right.
That you'd go out, and then you'd come back, and you had 20 days to get all your thoughts together, and then you gave a presentation.
And how many were in the course?
About 50. No.
50. So if you didn't have the money to go anywhere, what would you do?
You, like, one person, or a couple people stayed in, there's about four of us who stayed in America. I stayed in New York, and then the other three stayed in Washington on the islands there.
Right.
Because there's, there's islands everywhere.
Okay, so, what was the title of your report? Or the theme?
It was called Confused and Paranoid, A Winter in New York.
A Winter in?
In New York.
In New York. Now, are you describing the scene around Dana Beale's Confused and Paranoid, or yourself?
Just myself in general. And that whole scene, definitely.
So how did you know about him?
I the summer before, I went on a Greyhound trip for 45 days, and I met this guy in New York, this kid who's just starting college. And then my first day in New York, I left my sister's house. I walked down to Washington Square Park, and I was sitting there, waiting for something to happen. And this kid needed a lighter to light a cigarette, so I gave him a lighter. And then he's like, let's go over. Or no, then I realized that I'd met him before in New York. He was at his college a few months earlier. And then he invited me over to the Yippies. And I decided to make that kind of the focus of my trip, which I abandoned after about a month of it.
Okay, you're saying you met this kid on a bus, and it's the same kid in the park?
Yeah. I met him in New York at his college, and then months later ran into him in the park, which is kind of peculiar, I'd say.
But you met him at his college in New York?
Yeah, his college, at the dorms, at the site of the former Bellevue Mental Hospital.
Right. But what's that got to do with the bus trip?
Oh, I was on the bus trip when I met him.
Oh, okay. And you met him down in Washington Square Park. You met him in the dorm, then you met him a month later in the park, I guess.
Or, yeah, like 6 months later in the park.
Yeah.
Which is weird, because he was the first person I ran into in New York, the second time around.
Yeah, and the first time you were there was not for this course, it was another reason.
Right, it was just to ride around on the Greyhound.
Ah, I see. And he had been on the bus.
Well, yeah, no, he hadn't been on the bus, but I met him while on the bus.
Yeah, while on the bus, in the dorm, and then 6 months later, he's the first person you meet in New York City, and you are, you have not aware of Bleecker Street at that point when you meet him.
I'm not aware of what?
Of Dana Beale scene.
I wasn't aware of Dana Beale.
The way you want to say it. It takes a long time to
get out. Okay, all right.
Here we go, the last 20 minutes.
You're saying you talked to this kid on the bus. He told you about the Dana Beale Yippie scene?
I talked to the kid on the bus about something. 6 months later, ran into him. We recognized each other, and then he invited me over to the Dana Beale place.
Right. So that I'm assuming then that you went to study the tribes of Manhattan, not knowing you'd end up at Dana Beale's.
Oh, definitely not. No.
Oh, okay. So that was what you met, which really is a gain. The low-life street culture world that you were attracted to in San Francisco and Ashland.
Last 20 minutes of the interview with...
And film on your Safe Harbor TV program in Olympia.
Right.
So when you went... So you are assigned to check out this island. But you could have ended up at the Metropolitan Museum or in a lab. You didn't know where.
Which I did. Also, I ended up all sorts of places. But the main focus, I think, I was drawn to was just the hippies, because it was such a bizarre little world that they had going there. And, they had meetings every Tuesday, I think.
Yeah.
So it was something I could go to regularly.
Right, so you're studying the island, but it ends up focused on particular part, the main part of the Yippies. What's that in the background, do you know?
I thought it was in your background.
Maybe to Scott's background. I don't know what it is. Okay, I don't know what... Okay, so the thing is that you hang out with Dana. Now, my thought of that. So that's why the title is Confused and Paranoid. Is that the title?
That was the title of the presentation.
Likewise. Thank you so much, EJ, for sharing with us.
What's that noise, I wonder?
Yeah, I don't know. It must be in Scott's environment.
Okay.
He'll turn it off or shut it off or whatever. He's listening, but he's in the other room, so he may not be able to run back and talk to us. Okay, so... If we jump up to the disc you sent me of Safe Harbor TV, that's the name of your program on a local community station?
Yeah, that was the name of our show. It was me and about eight other people in Olympia, Washington on TCTV, which was the cable access network.
Right. And so you're the interview with the kid, the blonde kid or something, is he someone you know, or you just meet him, he's a lost kid, or is he a genius?
What was the blonde kid that you're referring to? Do you remember what he was talking about?
It was very close up to his face, and maybe he was, I don't know what he was talking about, but it stood out. Of the series of images that I watched, it seems to be at nighttime, he's downtown somewhere, and you see his fingernails a lot.
Okay.
Was he rolling a cigarette or something?
Maybe. That sounds familiar. But yeah, he would have been just someone that I knew in Olympia, definitely.
Right. Not someone you bumped into, you never met before, and just decided to tape him.
It sounds like probably not, but perhaps.
Okay. So, and then the character, the older guy, you're driving around in the car, I guess around the perimeter of Olympia, and he's talking about the rebuilding of Skid Row, the movement to bring back Skid Row. Who's that guy?
That guy's actually, his name is Arthur West, and he's an interesting person in that he was suing Weyerhaeuser.
Oh, yeah?
And the League of Women Voters and the Port of Olympia.
Yeah.
And he was suing all these people and trying to kind of combat Weyerhaeuser was purchasing the Port of Olympia, or working out an agreement where they could ship things through there. And he kind of had it in for them. And so he was using the law to kind of go after them. But he's like a paralegal activist, basically. And he shows up in court wearing leopard print pants and stuff like that.
And he has his own source of funding for this?
No, he lives... very impoverished. He, at the time, I think he'd won about $2,000 off of them over the course of like 6 or 7 months. He goes at it himself.
Yeah.
Like, lives on couches and all that. And that day we were going to serve someone with papers.
Right.
Was what that was all about.
Right. Okay, so, when did you film that one? Or tape it?
That was 2005.
Okay, so...
During the winter.
Right, so you've been in Olympia for a year and a half, almost 2 years. The first,
It was 2006, I'd say, actually.
Okay, so you're starting to do this course at Evergreen from 2003, the fall 2003 into 2004, and one of the things was to go to Manhattan. What other things happened at Evergreen? Did you stay within the course restrictions? Did you drop out?
No, I stayed with Evergreen. The following year, I took a poetry class. that focused, it was called Poetic Power. He kind of focused on using poetry, or using words as a weapon.
Right. It's called Poetic...
To get things...
Go ahead.
To get things done. And I kind of, I tended to focus, I got really fed up in that class, actually, and started supplementing it with more, like, fascist writers. It was definitely leaning towards the communist side, I'd say. So I was looking towards, like, the Italian futurists, and,
You started writing, other people. You started reading them.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Okay, so that was called Poetic Power.
Yeah, Poetics and Power, yeah. And
so,
then the following year was when I started to get into the video and film. The teacher of the Islands class also taught Media Works, which was an extremely exclusive program at Evergreen. It was the only film class, basically, and it was really hard to get into. But because I was in the Islands program, which I kind of got into as a whim, she told me that I could get into the Media Works program. And before that, I didn't actually have a real interest in ever making movies or really working with computers.
Yeah, you wanted to be a writer.
Yeah.
So you said it was a whim getting into the Islands course.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So are you working to pay for your college or your parents supporting you in this period?
Yeah, no, my parents were supporting me.
Yeah, because I don't know what the desires of college students are in that period, but maybe it's after the crash of .com, but everybody supposedly in college in the 90s was wanting to get into a business school or something, right?
That was trying to get into the business world?
Yeah, wasn't that the myth of the college students in the 90s?
Maybe. This was the early 2000s, and definitely not in Evergreen. No one was really trying to get into the business world.
Right, no, I know that. I'm thinking about how they said that, I've heard that in the 90s, no young students were interested in the humanities. They were into science that would lead to economics or computers or something.
Right.
Do you know that myth? Do you know about that mood of students?
I believe it. I know, like, lots of people that I knew during the dot-com era had dropped out of college. But yeah, I believe that myth.
Okay, so then, but to be doing what you're doing, studying Poetic Power, the obsolete literary world, in a way, for your generation, it sounds like a Don Quixote enterprise, though well encouraged at Evergreen. They were basing their attraction allure on literate humanities or something.
Evergreen?
Yeah.
They were basically what they were all about, and what I think they continue to be all about is they train you in such a way to where you won't necessarily be wealthy. But you will learn quite a few skills, and you will have an interesting time. Like, you can learn how to build ships. You can learn all sorts of stuff there.
So this is what David Worster has wrought. Wroughd. Interesting. So they were. Purposefully not gearing you to the average college student's ambition to get a degree to make money.
Yeah, definitely not.
Okay, and are there many colleges like that in the United States?
I honestly don't, I never really learned too much about colleges, which is one of the reasons I think that I ended up first at SOU and then at Evergreen is,
Yeah, you were into learning or something. You were not geared to getting your degree and going into to work and make a lot of money quickly or something like that.
Yeah, definitely
right?
Not.
You were exploring yourself. Were you using other forms of intoxications besides books? You were exploring all your central nervous system, all its faculties. Yeah. So here you are, you're doing the Poetic Power, which which led into media. Is that right? Into MediaWorks class or the porting
power?
Yeah, MediaWorks. Now, isn't it around that time you become aware of Jerry's Pixel World?
Yeah, it was at the beginning of MediaWorks. A friend of mine told me about the Pixel Vision camcorder, and I was under the impression, like, the deal with the Pixel Vision camera is that a 90-minute tape becomes about 7 minutes or 10 minutes, something like that.
Yeah,
because it plays at a really high speed. But I was under the impression that a 90-minute tape would record 90 minutes of video, and you know, so I thought it would just be really cheap. Like a really cheap way to make movies, like make documentaries. So I went out and kind of became fascinated with it and purchased one and then started shooting a movie on one. And towards the end of the movie, I called up Jerry because I found his phone number online. And yeah, then the rest is...
Then you started submitting pixels to his annual festival.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I've had one every year since I got a camera.
Now, Jerry recently interviewed you. Did he go into this, your youthful history, your early years, like we're doing?
Yeah, he did. He did a bit, yeah.
Okay. So the I'm interested in Evergreen State College. You're telling us a lot about it. What were the atmosphere? I mean, your type of personality and what you were doing was not the average there, or it was the average?
Not the average completely, but definitely not out of line.
Yeah. It was easy to find like-thinking people, like-minded kids.
It was easy to find a few of them, but not too many of them. But it was definitely, like, what I was trying to do, even if people weren't into it, it wasn't too far away from what they were trying to do.
Yeah. Did you ever hear of the Cosmic Awareness Communications pamphlets or anything about that while you were there? In Olympia?
I'm pretty sure that I had. I was thinking about that today. Like, one of the first places I went to in Olympia was the, I forget the name of it, but it was a black magic bookstore.
Yeah.
And when I first moved there, when I have questions as, like, where, you know, restaurants were or something like that, I'd go there and kind of ask the guy, and he'd always clue me into what to do and where to go. And maybe there, I heard of the cosmic awareness thing.
Yeah,
or maybe it was at Evergreen on the bulletin board. So
right,
definitely somewhere.
Yeah, they would. I know that they would distribute them in local cafes or places. The pamphlets,
yeah,
or whatever would be available locally. You could find out about them. So you didn't know when you made I'm Not Beer and looked at my chart. The word Rye, R-H-Y-E-E, you did not know that was connected to cosmic awareness or anything.
Yeah, definitely not.
And you were puzzled about what it meant, and you asked me. You never thought in your wildest dreams or conscious fantasies that it would, Rye would pertain to where you were in Olympia.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely not.
That was a surprise.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, before we get into that, what is the myth around Matt Groening? He is upset with the school now?
All I've heard is from other people. But supposedly, he came back to speak at a graduation or something and wasn't treated properly. and was like, fuck it, I'm done with these people. But maybe that's not true.
Right.
But that's definitely the myth.
That's the dorm rumor, the dorm gossip sort of thing. Did you stay in a dorm, or did you live off campus?
I lived off campus at Evergreen. I stayed in the dorms in someone's closet for a few months around the time that I went to New York on either side of that.
Why? Because you saving money, you mean?
Yeah, because I had to sublet my apartment.
Ah.
Sublet my room. So my friend's girlfriend let me sleep in their hall closet, which I kind of was into. it was kind of like a whole minimalism. Like, I had my sleeping bag and a laptop computer and some clothes, and there was a light in the closet, you know.
Yeah.
And it was about 6 feet or 7 feet by 4 feet, so I could sleep in there. I could roll everything up, work on the computer, read, I could do all that.
Right. So, but where did you live when you first got there?
Across the street in the forest, in a place called Cooper's Glen, which is an extremely derelict set of apartments that used to be like the married dorms, and then went independent.
Right. So you lived real low rent, low budget, while your years there. And how many years were you at Evergreen?
I was only at Evergreen, I guess I was there for 3.5 years altogether.
And that's, is that going two-thirds of the year?
That's going two-thirds of the year, except for the last year, in between Poetics and Power and MediaWorks, I took the experimental animation class. So I went through that.
Okay, so you're taking the experimental animation course. Are you aware of Pixel at the time?
No, not then.
But you're learning how to be an animator.
Yeah. I was learning stop motion, traditional 2D, strata cuts, and all that stuff.
So, let's see. Have we exhausted the Matt Groening thing? Is Matt Groening... every student knows that he went there, right? They hear about that.
Everyone knows that he went there. So actually, he didn't study. The woman that I took the class with, Marge Brown was her name. She had taught there when he went there, but supposedly he hadn't taken any animation classes. He published comics in the Cooper Point Journal, though, which I did too, and some friends of mine did also. Which was like the student newspaper. So I suppose we're linked up kind of like that.
Right. And
more than for animation.
I think when I met him in 77, which was through our mutual interest in Frank Zappa, he told me, I think he was president of the student council, something, he had some kind of position like that. Did you ever hear of that?
No, but I believe it.
Why?
Because the student council is... It is what it is. Like, it's not too official there, I'd say.
Right. So it would be loose enough for his kind of personality, maybe.
Yeah, it's definitely like, it goes from, you know, neutral to radical, I'd say, around there.
who's the female cartoonist that did the little girl cartoons that was a friend?
Linda Berry, I think is her name.
Yeah, Linda Berry. Did she go to Evergreen?
Yeah, she did. And she actually took the class, supposedly she took the animation class with Mark Brown.
Okay. So when I met Matt Groening in L.A. in the fall of 77, he was zero. He had just graduated, and he's told this story where he was working at a Xerox company, just making Xeroxes, doing that all day, and he was trying to do something creative, so he entered an ad. Some old Hollywood mogul or something wanted someone to help write his autobiography, so it required Matt to drive around in a limousine or something with the guy in the back pointing out different places where things happened in his life, and that was that was how you'd get facts about his life that Matt was supposed to work with. And that whole period of the Xerox machine and working with this eccentric old guy was life in hell, was what that refers to, because he was complaining a lot to me, because it was at that sort of recession period, the effect of the oil and energy crisis, so there was no jobs really for students in 76, 77, supposedly. So he thought it was ironic or depressing that he graduated and did well in college, supposedly, and then he ends up having what he considered a hack job, I guess, or a depressing job. So did you know in interviews he refers to that period as his hell period?
No, I've heard him refer to his hell period before, but I thought I was thinking that it was referring to the comic strip, but I guess, same thing.
No, like, well, the comic strip, the theme, Life and Hell...
Right, it's referring to...
It's referring to his own life, in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely seemed autobiographical, especially as I started to go, as I started going to Evergreen. So I'd read all those as a kid. I had a collection of them. And, you know, so I kind of, what I knew about college, I knew from those in some way. When he was talking about his, like, radical 60s professors and all that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny to be going to that, like, exactly what he was referring to.
So you grew up, you read, because you're born in 83, and Life in Hell starts showing up in 83 or 84, 85,
yeah.
And right when you're born, and so eventually you're reading them into the 90s,
yeah.
And you did not know, you did not know when you decided to go to Evergreen that Matt was from there, had gone there?
I did know then, but I didn't know when I was reading the comics.
Right. But so in a sense, you really were geared to go to Olympia. Since
yeah,
you were
definitely.
Young.
Yeah.
So the central point about Olympia is in the Cosmic Awareness Movement is the organization, the distributing of literature out of that area happened through Winston Turnbull, especially through the Paul Shockley phase, which was like 1975 to 1995. That third phase of the Cosmic Awareness Movement, the third medium, Paul Shockley, is the most well-known phase of the Cosmic Awareness Movement. And so people would, if they subscribed to the newsletter or whatever, or looked into it, they would know that the address was in Olympia, Washington. So it comes out of Olympia, that genre of information. Now, what's interesting is that I knew Paul Shockley, the medium for that phase. I knew Dave Worster, and he had involvements with Olympia when he was doing his mediumship, but he did not live in Olympia much. He lived mainly in Seattle, but they would have meetings in Olympia. And the person before him, Ralph Doobie, I think had involvements with people in Olympia. So it was more Seattle than Olympia in the beginning of the Cosmic Awareness Movement, but then it became Olympia. And the concept of Rai is that the original separateness that created the life in hell, okay, life in hell, life is hell, the idea of the separateness of the human condition was set up by the concept or the experience of Rai, the first separateness, this entity that did this from the astral plane. Without going into details, anybody's listening can read about it in Paranoia Magazine, the interview I do with Dave Worster, or go to Dobbstown.com and hear the 24 hours of the interview with Dave Worster. And it goes into the details of that. But what happened is that I knew Dave Worster and I knew Paul Shockley. I knew about the Cosmic Awareness Environment. And then I discovered the medium, Michael Blake Reed, in Toronto, who channeled the Evergreens. That was in 1974, and the Evergreens started in August 74, the very month that Dave Worster, due to a problem with the Paul Shockley and Olympia gang, they wanted to feature Paul Shockley, and so they de-emphasized Dave Worster. So Worster stopped channeling. Without going into details, he moved out of that activity. He was not channeling. But Dave Worster later, when I told him about the Evergreens, thought it was interesting. He said, maybe awareness that he channeled moved on to Toronto and through Michael Blake Reed as the Evergreens. Now, I'm probably the only person in the world who knew the awareness movement and the Evergreens. So the chart, the tiny note chart, is dealing with information I got from the Evergreens and information I got from Cosmic Awareness, as well as the various people mentioned in the chart, like Frank Zappa, Marsh McLuhan, LaRouche, May Brussel, Christian Murdy, Dr. Beter, Garrett Dean, William Irwin Thompson, Arthur Croker, and myself. But the theme is, the Rumpelstiltskin theme is Rai. So Dave Worster later he was not impressed with any medium after he did his mediumship, and he didn't think that he was channeling spirits, and he felt he was doing a different kind of mediumship. So he was not impressed with the Evergreens, and he took me a long time to get him to think about the Evereens and actually hear a tape of them. And so I was on the radio in Toronto and CKLN in the 87-91 period. And around 89, when my listeners knew a little bit more of what I was talking about, I started to bring in the cosmic awareness information and the Evergreens, and I used to talk about a battle between the Evergreens and the cosmic awareness, okay? And all the time, this is right when The Simpsons starts going out as a major entertainment meme, or it starts, and then it becomes a major meme for the next 20 years. This is like the anniversary now of it, 20th anniversary. So I'm thinking about The Simpsons. I didn't know it was going to become a huge phenomenon. And I'm thinking about the Evergreens. I'm thinking about cosmic awareness. And I'm thinking about Olympia. And Matt went to Evergreen College. And they used to sort of touch on these themes. And in 2000, when did we determine the earthquake happened? February 2001?
Yes.
Right. The earthquake in Olympia happens in February 2001. After Dave Worster had met with Paul Shockley, hadn't seen him since 1986. This is in early 2000, January 2001. And Paul Shockley was complaining about his life with Avaton. And he had stopped working with Avaton, the guy in Olympia, Washington, in 1995. And in the course of their discussion, Dave Worster, who hadn't seen Paul, you know, since 1986, they didn't. Dave Worster was not interested in Paul Shockley's channeling. But they met again, and Paul's complaining about Avaton, and Worster says, well, someone ought to give that guy a shock, or a bump, or a kick. That's what Worster is saying to Paul, commenting on Avaton. And Avaton is the publisher of the awareness stuff in Olympia. So about 6 weeks later, the earthquake happens in Olympia, Washington, which is about 5 miles from Avaton. The center was about 5 miles from Avaton's home. And when we discovered that, we heard it on the news, within 24 hours, I happened to call up Dave Worster just before that. And he had finally heard the Evergreens. A friend of his decided to have a reading with the Evergreens for someone who was passed over. And Dave thought it was interesting. He listened into it. So isn't this interesting? This whole drama that I was creating between the Evergreens and cosmic awareness, something in my mind, not really on the surface a reality. But when Worster finally heard the Evergreens, it triggered this earthquake, but the earthquake had been set up when he was talking to Paul Shockley about one of the propagators of the Rai myth, Avaton. Now, so these key parts in my chart, key themes, you end up in Olympia, Washington, February 2003, say, right? Or summer of 2003, like 2.5 years later after the earthquake?
Yeah.
And the then you meet Jerry Fialka, and then that leads to him assigning you the pixel that you created called I'm Not Beer. And so you have your, what do you remember about the earthquake? I mean, it happened 2 years plus before you arrived, but what was it talked about?
Yeah, the earthquake was referred to frequently. When I first moved there, the bridge had fallen down, or it had been partially destroyed, the 4th Street Bridge. So when I first moved there, it was still being rebuilt, and then eventually it's completed, and then I lived right next door to it for my last year there.
That would be the most public effect of the earthquake?
Yeah, and then you had mentioned before that the dome had shifted.
Yeah,
I had actually heard that before because it wasn't held down by anything other than gravity, right? So it when the earthquake happened, the dome shifted.
So right now, it wasn't strange that there was an earthquake in that area, because isn't that Vancouver, that, what's that bay, begins with P, the bay there.
The Puget Sound?
Yeah, Puget Sound. Isn't that area an earthquake-prone zone?
Yeah, I think so. The Mount Rainier is very close there. The whole time I was there, people were saying the Mount Rainier is going to blow up. Around the time that I heard about the Pixel Vision camera, the Mount St. Helens became active again. People thought that was going to blow up.
Right. And so there's this sort of ominous mood around Olympia. Earthquake.
Right. Yeah. I was pretty nervous when I left that, because it was taking a few months longer than I wanted it to move back to California. And
you thought you weren't going to make it.
Yeah. I was thinking about that a lot. That would be kind of a joke, get caught up in a volcano eruption.
Well, how many miles is Mount Rainier from Olympia?
It was, I think, like 20 miles or something like that.
Oh,
but
that's close.
The thing about that is when a volcano erupts, it'll trigger earthquakes, or earthquakes will trigger volcanoes, and they'll trigger tsunamis. Right.
Yeah.
And the volcanoes will melt the ice, which will trigger mud flows, and so everyone will die in theory.
Yeah.
Pretty quickly. Yeah.
Do the kids, did they discuss this kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Interesting. So it's like this looming disaster, Armageddon.
Yeah, definitely.
Is hanging over the town. So how long did you? Okay. So that's the atmosphere. And you didn't know if the earthquake was triggered by Dave Worster.
No, I never did.
who was the explainer of the Rai concept, which would become the part of the chart you'd make in your immortal pixel, I'm not there. It would be the hidden part that you did not know about, but you puzzled about it and asked me after we met, after you'd finished the video. So that's why we're doing this interview, is the amazing synchronicity here of your life leading to the question. And you're looking at this chart, trying to figure out how to translate it, the tiny note chart, and you looked at the word Rai, but you didn't figure, well, I don't know what that is, so you didn't translate that part, right?
Right.
Yeah, so you...
What I noticed that that all the people in the video all appear in the chart, right? So that's what led me to the chart, was once I saw Croker and William R. Thompson and all that in there. And the reason I kind of just gave up on the top part was none of them are in there.
That's... okay.
So I thought it was okay just to ignore that part.
Right.
I was referring directly.
Actually, this clarifies something here. What happened is that December 2007, I was at Jerry Fialka's after being in New Zealand, and he asked me to respond to Todd Haynes' movie, I'm Not There, which I hadn't seen. But I read a long interview with him and got the gist of the movie. So then I did the Marshall McLuhan, Lynn LaRouche, William Irwin Thompson, Arthur Croker, and Bob Dobbs' response to Bob Dylan. And doing it in five forms as the movie presented, sort of miming how the movie presented six versions of Dylan, right?
Right.
And that footage on Pixel of me imitating the different aspects and interpretations of Dylan went to you. You decided you couldn't work on that. And I didn't know this. You got to the chart because you were looking into me, saw the chart, and said, oh, the people that Bob just did on the responding to I'm Not There are in the chart.
Right.
That's how you got to the chart. Okay.
Definitely.
And so you didn't use the footage of me doing the five phases, or five quadrants, so you did the chart. And that was okay with Jerry. There was no rules on what you were supposed to do with this, right?
Right.
So those that know the chart find it interesting, what you've done with it. Now, why is it presented in this gray din, gray noise, gray, hardly can see the images, and every image in the, what is it, about 4 or 5 minutes long?
Yeah, it's 6.5.
6.5 minutes. Every image is lifted, referring to an image in the chart. Why did you make it that? What were you thinking of presenting such a low, what McLuhan called low visual definition? Low definition.
Right, yeah, the cool image.
Yeah.
It's specific to the camera itself. When you don't, like when you record on audio cassette tape, as you're supposed to, or as was intended with the Pixel Vision camcorder, it comes out looking like that. So I was exploiting just the inherent, the camera, like what it does, basically.
Okay, so because the pixel's going to make it low visual definition, and it's going to be a pixel.
Yeah, and then so if you record onto audio cassette tape, which I was, it'll come out extremely jittery. It's just, you know, audio cassette tape isn't very stable in general, so it just kind of, it degrades the image sharply. Most people will pick to record digitally or onto even, you know, VHS tape or whatever by plugging it into a TV.
Right.
Or into a VCR. But I guess I'm a purist in that I like to use the audio cassette tape.
Okay, so the concept, your interpretation of the editor, I mean, is not based on an idea. What we see is not based on an idea. It was based on the fact it had to be pixelized.
Right, yeah, it's based on that. And, yeah, it's mostly based on that. And I was shooting off of televisions.
Right.
I was putting all the images onto VHS tapes and then putting them through. I have these professional Super VHS VCRs that I got from Olympia, from the cable access station. And so I was manipulating the images, the speeds, by playing them forwards quick and back slow and all that.
Right.
And so that I was kind of thinking about, just like the manipulating the Android meme and how, like, people of my generation, you know, were engulfed in it and can deal with it in a way that other people cannot.
Right, so you felt that the pixel could, as a medium, could express that point.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because, I say that the Android meme is long gone, and the last gasp of the Android meme is it making you feel that you can, you know, control it, smear it, edit it, and not be dominated. Right. That's its last seduction. It's still there, but it's a very apparently weak
seduction.
Yeah,
it's no longer frightening.
Right. So when I saw the first thought, not knowing what you would create, I thought that was an accurate interpretation of the Android meme, this gray, distant thing with, you know, echoes and reflections from ancient scenes. Like in the chart, you've got Elvis and the Beatles. I mean, young kids today don't even know who they are. Who would they be, you know? Unless in some way in music or in school they heard about it. But the people named are so ancient in
right.
The people named in the chart. So, but you weren't thinking that, were you? You that's an afterthought of the pixelated effect.
I was thinking about the Android meme, yeah, and how by blending everything together, it kind of became like a stream of consciousness thing that you couldn't really put your finger on.
Right, and that was based on you listening to interviews or whatever. You knew I was saying that.
Yeah.
Now the in my essay Up the Orphic Ante, which is the essay explaining the chart, done in 95 or so. I talk about after 67, you have the cobwebs of Rai, according to Dave Worster. And Rai is gone by 67, but there's still this lingering after image. And to me, the digital technology is that. And we've seen what's happened to the digital world since the early 70s and how it's shrunk and become incredibly user-friendly. So the cobwebs of Rai are what the chart is a picture of, the cobwebs, because it's a picture of the Android meme. But because it was done in 95, it's an afterimage of the Android meme. So it's really ancient or gone or clouded over. And you literally did what is meant by my chart. But no, but So it was a combination of luck. You picked the right medium, or accidentally got assigned on the right medium to create that effect, and you also kind of knew that's what it should be because you had heard my stuff, right?
Right, right, right.
So the thing is the, how do I say this? When Rai, if Rai had not returned to Essence, according to Cosmic Awareness, there would have been a lot of destruction on the planet. And by 1994, like from 64 to 94, pretty well wiped out, you know, the worst kind of nuclear winter effect. And because of certain things done between 67 and 69, or 64 to 69, that period that Dave talks about in the Paranoia Magazine interview, it alleviated, so the grand design by those, that perverted part of consciousness that wanted to destroy this world, which would be part of the Rai complex or syndrome, they were, their agenda was confused, and their timing was off. So if there was an attempt to have a major clash in the Middle East in June 67 when they had the six-day Arab-Israeli war, and that could have led on to a major nuclear problem, you know, major battle that we've all been, for the last 40 years, waiting to happen, supposedly. Even now, you know, with Israel attacking Gaza, always brings up this Armageddon doomsday scenario, right? That is an image, a plan that was set in, say, 100 years ago, and it never got to pull it off. And so Wurst used to say that the earthquakes in these things, the tremors, the crises in politics, and Nixon's Watergate, you'll notice on the chart there's the McCarthy era, then there's the McCarthy scandal, the JFK scandal, JFK assassination scandal, and then Watergate and the Battle of the Harvest Moon with Dr. Beter, and on up to now. So the these were shakings of the grand design to wipe us, to have a negative denouement to the human experience here, and it never totally was able to be completely implemented. And so when earthquakes were happening over the last 40 years that I've known Worcester, that they would be sort of releasing mechanisms. So while you guys there at Evergreen were under this cloud of a huge, massive destruction of that area, and you'd all die, it was not going to happen because of the kind of things that did happen there. The earthquake, which just knocked out the bridge, knocked off the dome. And to me, studying Worcester and following what he'd done, it's incredible that you make this thing. Okay, because Jerry tells you to make a pixel based on the Dillon stuff, but you don't make nothing about the Dillon stuff other than the audio, which is me talking the five quadrants, right? That's all. And you go into the chart, but the chart is, and your own personal experience, since you're based in Olympia, you actually channeled what should come out of Olympia, because it had been coming out of there. The good news about the grand Armageddon would not work, would not happen. And you even worried about it as a result of the earthquake, that Worcester, on a strange, eccentric, synchronistic level, was part of implementing. But implementing an earthquake that would just do a minor shaking up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so Worcester didn't say someone should kill Avaton. He said someone should shake him up.
Shake him up.
and that is can be extrapolated to the shaking up of the doom over Olympia. The Mount Helens, what is it? Mount Rainier.
Mount Rainier.
Rainier's Armageddon, apocalypse, and all that stuff. I find it very curious that you were in the right place to do this and come up with this. Then, also, fill in, and remember, Worcester influenced the curriculum at Evergreen. You know, that's what's interesting.
Right, right, right. And I'm a product of that.
Yeah.
But I gotta go. We gotta continue this in a week.
Okay, so we'll continue it. This has been great.
Okay.
I'll think about another way to approach this. We got to the crux of the matter, but there's more. I want to go back into your creativity with the Safe Harbor TV and then relate it back to this strange synchronicity of what came out of Olympia.
Excellent.
All right. So thanks a lot,
okay.
Will.
Cool. All right.
Okay, bye.